recorded in Indianapolis, Indiana. Welcome to the Infamous Indie Podcast. I'm your host, Joe Melillo. This show features real-life stories of Indiana's most infamous horrors, Circle City serial killers, and crimes, both current and cold. I sit down and interview people who know these crimes the best. Sometimes they're authors, sometimes law enforcement, and even family members of the victims. In the end, you'll see a darker side of Hoosier hospitality. Always excited to bring you another week and another podcast here on the Infamous Indie Podcast. I'm Joe Melillo. Thanks again for listening. As you guys know, you probably know me by now, I like to switch things up. I kind of go with my gut on what you guys think you'll like to listen to, because that's what I want to listen to. So this week, I'm bringing you a body language expert. She's a friend of ours. Her name is Lisa Mitchell. You can look her up. We've been friends with her. When I say we, I mean Carrie and I, my wife and I, have been friends with Lisa Mitchell for a few years now, more than a few years. We actually met, and you'll hear the story on the interview about how we met Lisa, or how I met Lisa, at a party when she was just learning kind of the body language realm. And she brought us in to kind of be a part of an experiment for some kind of a dating experiment. It was a way for her to practice what she was learning. And I was honored that I was able to be a part of that. And my wife was there, and we were just dating at the time. And it's kind of funny. And now looking back at it, and you'll hear the full story in the interview coming up here. But again, today is about human trafficking. We're going to take some body language tips from Lisa and kind of pass them along to you to see how you can learn from a situation, or learn from her situation, and then ultimately how you can apply that in real life. And what are you supposed to do? And stay tuned at the end. Lisa's going to go over her tips, and you're going to learn a lot from our interview. But stay tuned at the end. I have some stuff, some articles, and just some tips that I think you all will be interested in. It goes a little deeper than what Lisa, Carrie, and I could go into. And again, I bring in Carrie this episode because I feel like a woman's perspective would be very helpful. Honestly, a woman's perspective might be helpful every single episode. No fooling. I'm not perfect, and I know my wife is much closer to perfection than I am. And I know that maybe bringing her on every episode could be definitely a positive thing. It's definitely worked out the last two episodes. Enjoy the interview. Stay tuned for the end, and I have some information that it's very practical that you can use to take with you and bring into the real world. And hopefully, let's make a difference and try to end human trafficking of any kind. All right. Enjoy. Hey, everybody. Welcome to the interview portion of the Infamous Indie Podcast. And with me are my two guests today. And introduce yourselves.
Hi, I'm Joe's wife, Carrie Melillo.
You may remember her from the last podcast. And
I am Lisa Mitchell. I am a communications expert specializing in body language, and also a certified forensic interviewer.
And also our friend.
And a friend.
Yes.
I get the distinct privilege of being your friend.
Yeah. And I consider you my friend as well. We see each other lot on at Wish TV, and specifically on Indie Style when you go and do those. But they bring you on as a body language expert. So
yes.
What started you thinking body language expert? And honestly, we have a story behind this as well. So
have gotten the front row seat to some body language training.
That legit, one of her first, what would you call that?
Yeah. So when I was studying and getting my credential to be a body language trainer in the nonverbal science, part of my training was to hold sessions. So to bring together a friendly audience that I could practice the research and the science and the activities and the engagement, and really get comfortable presenting the material as a professional in a new realm. And so I, as you guys may recall, had invited a room full of friends over, And I believe we did the science of dating and romance was the session that we did, right? And you guys at the time were dating. You were the only man in the room, Joe. And I just loved it. I was like, oh, this is so fun. Because it opened up. I remember it opening up a conversation. I can't remember exactly what the tactic was or what skill we were talking about. Something around decoding. I think it was like decoding nonverbal cues or like maybe understanding when somebody's frustrated or angry or not saying something. And I, just a conversation, you guys kind of like sidebarred and were like dissecting your relationship mechanics, which I thought was really cool. And having not really had a lot of experience with that, it was really fun to see. I'm like, oh, this is going to be something that helps a lot of people and can really be a great conversation starter.
Do you remember that, Carrie?
Yes, I do. It was, we just first started dating, so it was a little awkward, but it was really fun.
Yeah, because I remember asking you, Carrie, like, are you sure? Like, are you sure, A, that you want to bring him, and B, that you want him to know this stuff? Because then he's going to be able to read you. And
but then we would be able to read him.
Right, exactly.
Everybody's laughing.
So Joe was the token man in that session, but it was super fun.
And funny that it just, our relationship, our friendship has kept on since then and just... And you've continued on that path, and very impressively, we all must say, you go in front of hundreds of people and talk about what you're an expert at.
Yeah.
And it's just very impressive, and we're very proud of you.
Thank you. Well, I only got into this because I used to suck so bad at it. And for me, like most of like my backstory is I basically imploded my life about 10 years ago, like shut down my business, divorced my husband, moved away, like just pulled the plug on everything. And when the honest moments of like, how did I end up here? Because I'm a type A overachiever. Like I don't lose and I don't suck and I don't fail. And I did all of that. And it was really like, because I sucked at communication. Like I was missing clues. I wasn't paying attention. I wasn't being thoughtful or responsible with what I was saying or expressing what I needed. So it was all like the root cause of everything that sucked at that time was really just not being good at communication, not being able to decode people, not understanding how I was setting the temperature in rooms and how detrimental that was. So learning the skill was really like selfishly just so I don't repeat what went wrong last time. Mm-hmm. And it just happened to be something that a lot of other people can benefit from too. So it's been fun to get to share that power.
I'm just floored because what you do and what you, if you have never seen Lisa on Indie Style or any other program like it or heard her speak, she breaks it down to a point where it's really easy for people to understand. And so that's what we're kind of going to do for everybody and our listeners today, in a sense. We're going to take your expertise. I mean, we thought about doing this podcast a while ago, and I've been kind of getting them in the list of which ones I want to do next. And you were up, and I tell you, I think people are going to learn something. I think we should try to teach people something, but also, just your experience. You have an interesting story that fits perfectly for our infamous indie theme. Yeah, as always, the podcast is crime-based, so very similar. So human trafficking in Indianapolis, if you didn't know, is big. It's a big industry in the sense there's a ton of conventions. It's one of the most used convention cities in the world. We're known for all the conventions we host, and in that turn has this other darker side of the society, which is girls are trafficked in and then used for prostitution. So our police force has a lot to deal with during that. And you have a connection, a story that's very interesting.
Is it mainly women or is it women and men?
I don't know. That's a good question. I think that's something I can look into, but I don't actually know that.
Yeah, the demand is, it's usually, you know, women, young women. And then, as I understand it, for children, you know, it's kind of almost equal, you know, boys and girls from that demand, as morbid as that is. But it is something that is prevalent here, as Joe mentioned, in the city of Indianapolis. You know, like Super Bowl, when we hosted it, was one of the largest, you know, anytime Super Bowl is held anywhere, the Indy 500, anytime there's a large influx of male spectators, there's an influx of people bringing, you know, literally driving across the country with girls and boys to be taken advantage of. Yeah. And by this. So it's supply and demand, as old as economics itself. It's sick. And it's one of those things where it's so prevalent, not just during big events, but it's happening all of the time, and that you are probably interacting with human trafficking victims every day and just not knowing what you're seeing. The other thing that's really interesting too is from a victim mentality is a lot of times because of how these kids are groomed by their pimps or by the people, even a lot of times it's family members, first of all. So they're in a relationship of trust with the person who is then exploiting them. So a lot of times when victims are interviewed, they don't even necessarily know that they're a victim. They don't necessarily know that there's something being perpetrated against them. And so that's why someone who knows that they're in danger or, you know, knows that there's some sort of sinister act happening react differently than people who just think it's like, oh, well, this is how they show me love or this is my responsibility to the family. So picking up the cues can be kind of difficult for people who don't identify as a victim, and a lot of them don't, but there's dynamics that you can watch between the victims and the people who are controlling them mm-hmm. that can help clue you in, even if the victim themselves doesn't necessarily identify that way.
You've worked with law enforcement before?
Yes.
Yeah. Tell the listeners how and why.
Yeah. Well, a lot of what I do is on the forensic interviewing side. So that's when law enforcement officers or investigators are actually trying to get the truth from, and it's not just from criminals or people that have allegedly committed crimes. It's getting victim statements too. And so it's how do you, as a law enforcement officer, as someone who has a level of intimidation just by your badge.
Yeah, wearing a badge, yeah.
Right. You're dealing in a high consequence environment. You're dealing with people that have been threatened or have been, you know, scripted as to what you can say and what you can't say. How do you walk into a room? How do you help set the temperature? How do you gain trust? So it's not just decoding what's across from you. It's also how are you managing yourself mm-hmm. in those rooms to get people to want to tell you the truth or to feel safe to tell you the truth or to be, you know, to show empathy and to show compassion when taking victim statements in a way that make people feel really seen and heard and safe. Mm-hmm. Because if any of those elements are missing, they're not going to talk. So it's really as much decoding. Most law enforcement officers, most investigators are really skilled at decoding nonverbal cues and statement analysis and all the tools that they have to dissect what's going on across from them. But what a lot of them forget from just years of doing this work is kind of how am I showing up in the space and how is that impacting the outcome of my investigation or my interviews. So a lot of the work that I do there is really focused back on them and challenging them to think about, you know, what's your intention? What kind of mindset are you in when you're walking in? How are you, you know, are you keeping your hands visible and trust? How are you using your space with a victim or with a perpetrator? You know, what type of angle are you sitting at them? Are you sitting side by side? Or are you sitting offset so they don't feel confrontational or they don't feel like they're being punished or it's punitive, right? Just even how you position your body in an interview when there's a high level of sensitivity and emotionality can change how forthcoming that person can be in giving you information.
So there's confession tapes on Netflix, and it's very interesting. It's about false confessions.
Yes.
And you can see some of those tactics in the false confessions. Who knows? You know, I'm not going to make a call whether or not those are false confessions or not. That's, you can watch Netflix and make that decision yourself. But it's interesting that you bring that up because that's definitely something you can see in that.
And I never thought of the body language coming from the person, the cop, or whoever is asking the questions. I always thought it was more so you did more so work with the victims.
Yeah, you're trying to read the victims. Yeah.
And there's a big part of that. I mean, that's definitely part of the skill. And that's why usually, you know, you mentioned confession tapes and any of the true crime shows that you see or the 2020 segments, a lot of times you'll notice that there's an officer. And there's usually a table between them and whoever they're interviewing, whether it's victim or alleged perpetrator. And then you can always see under the table and there's almost always someone observing. So there's someone mm-hmm. who's not questioning, who's just looking and just reading. When do they, when do they show protective measures? When do they show distancing behaviors? When do they do mouth blocking or eye blocking? Or when do they turn their body away? What's the sensitivity around certain questions? So you know what to circle back on, what to dig deeper in, what to put pressure on.
How much can we believe this when we have, I'm putting you on the spot. How much can we believe this when we have lie detector tests?
Yeah.
Or, we're going off what you think, Lisa, yeah. I don't know if we should believe you.
Yeah, well,
but it works.
Right. So there's a science behind this, right? So there's 17 statistical cues of deception. So that's where your body physiologically is telling on you when you lie. So it's everything from increased blink rate to the blood vessels inside your nose swelling slightly to make your nose itch. So you may see a lot of nose touching. There could be change in heart rate. There could be change in perspiration rate. There can be splotching or blanching of the skin. Your body hates when you lie because it knows. And again, this is not necessarily applying to psychopaths or sociopaths, because they have a slightly different cognitive process around what's real and not, or deception.
Right.
Or
so truth. You might be fooled by a serial killer, but.
Well, most serial killers are, oddly enough, not sociopaths. There's other pathology around that, but a lot of times they still will feel guilt, or they'll feel remorse, or they'll feel, yeah. So it's sure. really you have to kind of know what the cognitive processing of that person is to know exactly which cues or signals. And the important thing when you're looking for cues, there's no silver bullet of lies, right? There's not one thing that you can see. There's a lot of false information. Oh, if somebody looks down and to the left, they're lying, right? Well, no, because there's...
We've been sticking on that for a long time. I see right, Carrie's face. Right. Carrie always does that to me. After you said it to her, she always is like, Joe, you're looking down to the left. I think you're lying.
No, but that's a myth. That's what I always use as an example of a myth, is that there's no one singular... there's a concept called clustering, right? And it doesn't mean it's not.
Right.
But what you want to do is you want to look for clusters and you want to confirm. So you're looking for three or more indicators of the same behavior or outcome before you draw a conclusion. So you would see if someone's lying, for instance, you may see increased blink rate, you may see blanching of the skin, and you may get a blocking behavior. They may physically turn their torso away from you, they may touch their eye, they may cover their mouth.
Their legs?
You would see, depending on where they started from, right? Because baseline, nothing counts without a baseline. So until you know what's normal for someone, you can't track variance. Mm-hmm. So baselining is step one. Without a baseline, that's why in any type of questioning you will see at least a brief segment of rapport building, which is non-consequential, either things they can't lie about, name, address, stuff that's easily verifiable, or things that have no reason to be lied about that don't carry a consequence. So you see what's normal for this person. Baseline is lots of things, and I won't go into all of them, but it's essentially, what is normal for that person? How do they normally sit? What's their rate of speech? What's their cadence? What type of verbal fillers do they use? What do they do with their hands? What do they do? Are they animated? Are they less animated? What's normal? And then as you progress into targeted or higher consequence questions, it's what looks different than it did at the beginning.
It's a great explanation.
Yeah. So it's variance. You're looking for variance. Variance is an indicator of just greater concern, where you would want to go into deeper questioning or more verification. Sometimes for law enforcement, it's actually then they know where to go look for, additional evidence, or they know who else they need to talk to. It's not always a gotcha, here comes a confession, right? A lot of times it's collecting those little pieces to know this is something that didn't look like the baseline, and we need to go further into this with whatever investigative method is going to get us to the truth.
Wow. Have you ever been in a room with police officers while they're questioning people?
No.
Have you ever been outside the room while you watched someone question? Okay.
No. My instruction is usually in a classroom.
Sure, sure. That's something I thought. Yeah. I was like, oh man, I don't think I've ever asked you that. So.
Yeah, no, I'm not a practitioner from that standpoint.
The reason we're talking specifically about human trafficking and kind of reading the body language is because you have a specific story, an experience that happened to you in life, in person.
Yeah, yeah. It was I think it was actually New Year's Day or somewhere. It was really close to New Year's. A year, a year or two ago, and I was just shopping. I was at a retail location at a mall here in Fishers, and it was just me and the store clerk, and it was sunglasses, so it's not a high volume kind of, you know, it's not like Target or whatever where there's a bunch of people. There were only two of us in the store. Mm. This girl looked behind the counter, looked to be maybe 18 or 20. I was wrapping up. I was just finishing up my purchase, and then this girl walked in and was with an older gentleman. And not, I mean, older. She looked to be 13 or 14. I have a daughter who's that age, so that's, you know, my basis for comparison. And he looked to be mid to late 20s. And the first thing I noticed was he, knowing how a normal person walks into a store, it's a sunglass store, there's only so many things to look at. He was very frantic in his movements. So the first thing I pinged on, kind of over my shoulder and looking at the mirrors around me, was he was loud, and he was bouncing around the store, and he was physically touching her in a way that was not normal for, if it was a relative or if it was even an older boyfriend kind of situation. Like, it was always grabbing by the arm. It was physically moving her around. And at 13 or 14, like my daughter, if I tried to move her around like that, would be like, stop it. Like, quit touching me. I'm looking at this, right? And there was no resistance. There was no, she was very, very compliant. She was very quiet. He was telling her what to try on and what to do when she was trying things on. And these are, you know, $200-$300 sunglasses, which given their appearance was not necessarily somewhere that you would think that they would be shopping. So not to sound elitist or snobby, but it was a mismatch of observation, right? So again, looking at all of these cues, what doesn't fit, what's not normal for the scene. There were like 10 in the first 30 seconds that they walked in the door.
And Fishers is a pretty high class community in general. I mean, we're up here in near Hamilton County, near Noblesville, and
we are in Hamilton County.
Are we?
Yes.
Oh man, we are in Hamilton County. Yeah. Anyway, so yes, it just didn't fit well
it
with
didn't
the story,
fit well. Right? And so this the level of discomfort that the sales clerk was exhibiting really amped up really quickly. And so we're, and I couldn't see exactly what was going on because my back was turned to them. And so her eyes were really big, and she's like something's really weird here. She got like kind of scared. And I said, you know, I just tried to reassure her. I'm like, hey, cause I was basically done. I'm like, just act like you're ringing me up, right? Like, clean the lenses, like, do something, like, just stall, right? So we're kind of game planning and talking, and they're kind of, but it just keeps getting weirder and weirder, like, the way he's interacting with her and the way she's
anything specific
compliant with him.
Anything you see, you remember that he said?
He was saying things that were just, and again, given the dynamics of not knowing exactly what the relationship was, there were some things that had like some like sexual innuendo on it. Or things that you just wouldn't say to a 13-year-old about how sexy you looked, or oh, remember those pictures I took, or like so-and-so is really going to like you in these. Like, it was just like,
wow.
It was just every like hair on the back of my neck was standing up, and I'm like, this is so weird. I started getting sweaty. Like, I started having a physiological reaction to my level of discomfort around it. And so we just kept stalling, because I'm like, I don't know what's going on. So she's like, I'm afraid. She's like, I don't know what to do. And I said, well, just, you know, I said, are the cameras on in here? And she's like, yeah. And I said, okay. I said, I'm going to act like I'm taking a selfie so I can get pictures of the two of them. Right. And so,
yes.
I'm like, oh, will you take a picture so I can, you know, see how I look in these or whatever. So she and I kind of started game planning.
I remember these pictures. If you remember, I did this story for Wish.
Yeah.
As a reporter.
Yeah.
And you were like, you got to hear this story. And you showed me the pictures, and it's good. It's good. You're great at acting.
Yeah, I was like so sweaty, because, you know, like, you get nervous and you don't know, because he had like kind of all the the hallmarks of like meth usage, you know, like the lesions on the face and just like there's just kind of that look.
We call it in the news industry meth mouth.
Yes. Yeah. So it was that times 10. But she was dressed real nice. You know, he had on like Carhartt overalls or whatever. He looked like he just came off a job site of some sort. So it just nothing matched about the two of them being together. And so we just kept stalling and the sales girl was like, well, can I help you? And then I started interacting with her a little bit and just said, oh, you look, you know, those look really pretty. Like, which ones are your favorite? I'm like, oh, I'm just waiting on mine. You know, which ones do you like? And so she was like really hesitant to talk to me and kept looking at him. Like, could she talk to me? And then he would come over and get her and like take her to a different part of the store.
So he wouldn't allow you to talk to her?
He wouldn't allow me to talk to her. And so that, again, was like another just signal, cue that something was really wrong. And then I'm trying to remember exactly, it's been a minute, what the catalyst was, but he got really agitated and really angry and really, like, physical with her and, like, basically, like, pulled her out of the store. Like really abruptly. And then they were parked across the street from the store and like he drug her to this, like drug her to the passenger side of the car, like shoved her in. And I can't hear them, but I can see him in the car, like screaming at her, like super exaggerated, screaming at her. She's like shrunk down in the passenger seat of the car. So I go out as they're backing out. I take pictures of the license plate. I call 911. I was just so like, I was physically just shaking because I'm like this, the whole scene was so bad and he like just drove off with her and I'm like,
there she goes.
Like, what do we do? Yeah. Like how, like that, I'm like, I don't know what that, I don't know if it's human trafficking. I don't know if it's domestic abuse. I don't know what it is, but it is bad. Like the whole vibe was so bad about it. And so I go back into the store, the clerk is crying. She's like calling her manager and the police were there fairly quickly. I gave them the information.
Did they look at the video?
They were pulling security. They looked at my pictures. And so they, you know, they were super responsive, very quick. They actually, because I stayed with the clerk until somebody else got to the store to help her. And then I tracked down the security. Because I was like, I don't want to like mall security. I want like city security. And then I guess they're sanctioned with the same authority. Like the people that are at Hamilton Town Center are actually the same like Noblesville police officers. So they have full jurisdictions. They can do arrests or whatever. But they were gone. They were off mall property. But what they were able to do is like an hour later, they found the car at a gas station. Someone else at the gas station had called the police as well when they saw them interacting, and so they were
able. That is not a body language expert.
No, that was just somebody who was in the store that was like, this vibe is so bad. So that's the thing, I don't give myself too much credit as an expert because the vibe, it was so bad.
Yeah,
like anybody with awareness who didn't have their face in their phone and were clued in would have picked up on the vibe, right? The fact that somebody else took to call, like actually thought, hey, this is bad enough that I'm gonna call 911. That they were able to actually locate them. He had a warrant for his arrest. There was a... So it, from what I'm told, and I had to do some serious digging because information was not easy to find once the arrest happened. But I do know that the vehicle was towed. He had a warrant for his arrest. There was several open investigations from a family services DCS abuse standpoint involving him and other family members. And this girl has a younger sister. So there was this whole, and they said, we can't really tell you anything and we can't really talk about it, which is part of the reason I had to really pull back on the news story and like I couldn't share a lot of things,
and honestly,
at the request of the police,
and they tell me very similar things they're going to tell you, and because they know where it's going, and they don't want to release information or names or and protect the children first and foremost. So that's the explanation that we get from police,
right? And so what I was able to do, because I have friends that have access to information was offline, make sure it was followed up on, make sure that the investigation continued. So I know, I don't know exactly what the resolution was. I do believe the children were removed from the home, not immediately, but that was another, those two incidences, because what they found when they went back on the video is that they had been in the store several times and had shoplifted and had stolen merchandise in the vehicle. And so there was like, they were using her to, as part of their criminal activity, to secure property to steal for them. That was just part of the story. So in this case, it wasn't straight human trafficking. There was definitely some very bad things happening, in that home. And the girls were not safe. And so ultimately, I believe these additional pieces really helped them get more action taken, or maybe expedited action that was already in process.
Well, and they found him.
Yeah.
Because there was a warrant out.
Yeah. So he was handcuffed. He was taken to jail. I don't think he stayed there, but then she was released into, she was not in his physical presence, at least at that time, which was really what I wanted to make sure was the end game. So not human trafficking,
per se,
right? I don't know how far that paper trail went. I wasn't privy to the case details.
But similar to human trafficking.
Being controlled.
Yeah.
Not having, like, the hallmarks of human trafficking, if you're out and about. And, you know, I would love for every convenience store worker and for every fast food drive-through window worker to be trained on recognizing human trafficking, because these are the places that are easy access, that are most frequently, you know, where you're getting a, I mean, think of how intimate of a look that you get inside someone's vehicle from a drive-through window. Right? Or think about what you're seeing as people are coming in to use the bathroom or getting gas or whatever, you know, like these frontline, and there's a lot of work in the hotel and the hospitality industry going on. Like, there's all sorts of training programs, and a lot of the hotel chains have taken it upon themselves to train staff and airport staff, you know, flight attendants for looking for international or even cross country kind of trafficking there. So big industry is looking, but it's like the everyday retail workers and the people that are on kind of the front lines of seeing, because maybe someone's being trafficked and they don't ever get out of the vehicle. Right. Maybe it's only drive-thrus. Maybe it's only quick stops at the bathroom at a gas station. Right. Maybe
because they don't want to be seen and they don't want to risk them getting caught.
Right. Right. And so the people that are in these, and it's like not being able to move on your own. Right. So someone either physically touching you, moving you, standing guard over you, limiting your interaction. So not being able to speak freely, or looking for permission to speak, or looking for approval of what you can say or what you can't say, you know, those little things that are quick, but if you know what you're looking for and you kind of know what bounce it against what normal looks like. Like if you see an older person, male or female, with a younger child, like most people kind of have an idea of what that interaction looks like, right? You have a baseline of like, how do they touch you? Where do they stand? You know, how much space do you give a 12-year-old at a convenience store to go look at candy or whatever, right? If you're seeing someone who's not being allowed that freedom of movement or not being allowed that freedom of communication, that is a flag. Mm. Like there is a reason that person does not want them. Like I am a super mama bear. Like I am way protective. Like even at her age now, like if I could make her keep a hand on the cart at Target the whole time, I would, because I'm still there and I have the curse of knowledge of like how easily and quickly this happens. But I will give her, you know, a couple aisles over, you know, down the aisle, like she gets a little freedom. So if you see somebody who's the amount of connection is not appropriate for the age, like trust your gut. Like I think most people ping on like, that's weird. Like, that doesn't feel right, or that doesn't look right.
Carrie's an expert at that. We get it all the time. I mean, seriously, but you're usually right.
I have gut feelings a lot, but it's...
I play devil's advocate.
Yes.
Because I try to make sure that we're not just assuming right away the worst.
Yeah.
Let's try to figure it out together.
Yeah.
It's the gut feeling, but then, you know, not... I feel like not a lot of people trust their own gut at that point.
Well, and the problem that we have now too is that there is, I mean, it's a super litigious society, right? You can get sued for anything. I really, even even pinging a strong, like viscerally responding to that situation the way I did, where I was like sweaty and I felt like I wanted to cry. I had that strong of a response, and I still like argued with myself about like, do I call security? Like, do I get involved? Do I talk to her? Is it my place? Like, we're.
Well, you did.
I did, because I couldn't.
So maybe it was, but it was visceral, but there.
I really argued with myself before I called 911 about that, because I'm like, what if I'm wrong? What if I get somebody, you know, what if they track him down and pull him over and it's her, you know, uncle? Or like, what if it's totally fine? Or what if it's me just being paranoid or intrusive? You know, like, I think we kind of argue with ourselves about not wanting to get involved, like the bystander effect, right? Mm. Well, if something's really wrong, somebody else will do something about it,
her mom or somebody closer to her.
Right. It's like, well, who am I to get involved? Or somebody, right. If it's really a problem, like, well, I'm not an ex, somebody else will intervene, right? Like, somebody else, but
yeah, kick the can.
But nobody does, like, that's the problem. Yeah. That's why we have so many people videotaping violent crimes or people drowning or areas where if they would just get out of bystander mindset and get into action mindset, they could totally change the outcome of a situation. But we all think somebody else is going to do it, or somebody else is better equipped to do it, or we're, God forbid, we're wrong. Like, what if I'm wrong about that whole scene and I just called the cops and now I'm like,
who cares?
Right. And that's eventually,
that's what we're telling our listeners.
Yes. And
do
you
something.
Right.
Get involved. If you really, like, viscerally, like you said, showing physical signs of reaction to a situation, you know, trust your gut. I mean, what's the worst thing you could say? I'm sorry, I thought this person was being trafficked, and clearly I'm not an expert. I just wanted to make a difference.
Yeah.
And that's all you need to say.
Yeah. But I think people are, they're afraid to get involved. They don't want to get into other people's business, which I'm the last one that wants to get tangled up in something like this, right? Like, I don't want to see it. I don't, half the time I don't even want to think that it even happens because it's so horrendous. Like, I can't wrap my brain around it.
And here in you know, this nice part of Indiana.
Yeah.
This is where we're not talking rural Indiana where they can be hidden in basements.
Right. No, it happens. It happens in plain. I mean, these people are moved around all the time, easily, in broad daylight. And again, because they don't always feel like, they don't know how to identify as a victim. It's just maybe they're normal, or someone has told them that that's what they do, or maybe they've just been threatened for so long that it's just easier to do what they're told to do than to argue. Like, sometimes people don't recognize they're a victim, or don't feel like they're, and it sounds horrible to say, doesn't feel like they're entitled to be a victim, right? Like, it's just their fault or whatever story they've been told. And so if people who see these things don't intervene or don't give the opportunity for someone else to intervene, when does it stop? Mm. It doesn't, right? And so I think if this was my daughter, if someone saw what I saw and didn't take action, like, how devastating would that be? For her and for me and for everybody else, right? So I think ultimately my plea to your listeners would be, like, if you ping on something, even if something just, like, your intuition is so good. Like, it's such a great tool. It's the best decoding tool that we have. And it's something you can hone and develop further, but it's something everybody starts with the baseline on. You know, just get your face out of the phone, look around. If you hear somebody's tone of voice that doesn't make sense for an interaction that they're having, you know, if somebody's rate of speech is super fast and there's nothing to be frantic about, if somebody's too close or somebody's physically touching someone else when there's no context, like, why do you need to police me in a store that's 400 square feet and you can touch me from the other aisle, right? Like, what? You know when something doesn't look right. Mm. You may not know why, but if it doesn't look right, chances are, even if it's not human trafficking, there's something bad. There's some sort of victimization happening there, even if it's a controlling boyfriend or a codependent or abusive, you know, consensual relationship that's unhealthy, right? Like, that's still something. That's still something that you could help intervene in.
And you did say something earlier that, thought about it this way too, because we're talking, most of the time since we've been talking, everybody thinks male and female, but
right,
like you said, there's female abusers,
right,
and male children,
yes,
victims,
victims who are being trafficked just as much. So.
Yeah, most trafficking victims, the overwhelming majority are not random people that are snatched off the street and kidnapped. Most people that are involved in trafficking are trafficked by family members or trusted adults. So these are people who are maybe having substance abuse issues or having financial issues or have a boyfriend who is controlling them or a girlfriend who is controlling them and exploiting their children. Like most sexual exploitation and trafficking is an inside job. And that's why it's so hard to see, because we don't want to see that. I mean, can you imagine someone pimping out their kid? It happens all the time. Right? Like it's not something that most
the numbers are too stable, too much to right. not be happening.
Most people that are listening to this are have relatively stable home lives. They maybe haven't had any form of abuse in their life, or their parents are trusted adults, you know, but think of all the kids that are in foster care, you know, with the opioid epidemic, there's so many children that are under guardianship that aren't family members or extended family members who maybe don't have their best interest at heart. And there's very little oversight, and it's so easy. It's so easy for the exploitation. And then you factor in the digital exploitation and the access that people have to basically shop for this type of stuff online and then have it delivered to your door, like Amazon. It's something that can feel so overwhelming. So when you see anything, like, you have to do something.
Carrie's face, you are just...
I want to, like, make a pause, because if we have to cut it out. Like, I just don't understand how do people do this? Like, how do people go about and find these people? Like, is it all dark web? Is it all in our face on...
No, you know. I mean, it can be, but more, I think it's the dark, deep web, I should say. Deep web.
The deep web is part of it. I had the pleasure and horror of sitting through a presentation by a cyber crimes officer who specialized in dark web crimes against children. And so he had a graphic, and I'll never forget it. He had a graphic that were like the 8 layers of the dark web. And so layer 1 and 2 is like gift card fraud and like financial, like trading of social security numbers and identity theft, right? So
identity theft is just 1 and 2.
It's like 1 and 2, right? Or like drugs or, you know, weapons or whatever. So there's like as you move through the layers, right, then it gets literally deeper and darker. Like you can hire, like, okay, I want to watch someone be murdered or mutilated, right? So you can put a rec out on layer 7 with the right level of approval, and someone will go bring that to you or record that for you or provision that for you for the right price. And it's all cryptocurrency, and the servers are in at least 12 different countries, so no one has jurisdiction to prosecute anything. So everyone's watching it happen. And no country has legal jurisdiction to prevent it or intervene or prosecute it.
And this is where the world order comes in and takes over the whole world, because this is happening and we want to stop it.
But the stuff on level 7 and 8, I'm not even going to say it out loud because it burned a hole in my brain.
There's a few podcasts out there, one of which is one of our favorites, is Sword and Scale, where there is deep web conversations that people have about children and what they're doing to them. If you want, I would suggest not eating before it.
Yeah.
And also just be in a place where you can just, like, take a break.
Yeah, it's supply and demand, right? And so there is a demand. Mm-hmm. There is a demand. And the demand is coming from people that are in your house and in your neighborhoods and in your school and wearing uniforms and running your churches. And I mean, you look at any list of perpetrators, right? There was just a raid in South Carolina. And one of the officers that supposedly was talking to a 13-year-old girl that had set up a rendezvous when he showed up for this sexual encounter with, luckily, an officer, he was wearing his uniform and driving his police cruiser.
The male who was busted for this?
Yeah, a cop was busted.
Yes, in his uniform, arrived at the location to supposedly have, he thought he was going to have sex with the 13-year-old, and with his uniform on in his police cruiser. Like, wow. That's how brazen, like, that's how brazen and how untouchable people think they are based on technology and based on anonymity and based on things that disappear, like Snapchat or the dark web, right? So if there aren't people doing this work, if there aren't people looking, I mean, I thought about this guy's career, right? Like, he had been an officer, he was based out of Texas, and he had been doing cyber crimes against children for over a decade. So every day, all day long, you're immersed in this. And it's like no wonder that the suicide rate for officers is so high and the narcotic rate for officers that do these crimes, you know, are so high. Because, and that's particularly frustrating because, like, if you're out in the public, at least you have a chance to decode the situation. Like, you have a chance to see the nonverbal cues. You have the chance, you know, it's really, if you're in a situation where someone is being, these crimes are being perpetrated online and these children are being exploited virtually, it's really you as an adult in their life, in their peripheral, to be able to notice the behavior of that child indicating distress.
It takes a village.
Yeah, it really does. And you can't not get involved. And that's it. We're all so much like, oh, I don't want to get sued for defamation, or I don't want to get...
Yeah, but how often does that really happen?
Well, not as much as we like to think it is, but it's a handy excuse to not take action, right? It
seems to be right there for you.
Yeah, there's lots of excuses why you can't get involved, but there's also lots of reasons why you have to get involved.
So the three lessons, I think, the three things we can take away. One, I think first and foremost, do something.
Yes.
See something, say something.
Absolutely.
I love it, you know.
And don't think it's just a male with a young girl, like... Broaden your scope of what you think trafficking looks like.
Child, male, boy, sex trafficking is just as prevalent, if not more,
right,
than women, young girls,
and less looked for and less identified.
Right, as we've known in all the true crime podcasts, there's always usually one.
Right.
The two. What would you take away, Carrie? What was something that
the signs that you can look for? So. Do you want to go over those again real quick?
Yeah, sure. Lisa? So someone whose movement is restricted. So if they're being unnecessarily touched, being kind of herded around, having someone stand too close to them, someone who's not able to communicate freely or speak on their own. So they don't say their name. They don't say what they want. They look to someone else for permission. And someone who just is really withdrawn, right? So they're sticking close. They're always looking for permission. There may or may not be signs of fear. I mean, this relationship almost seemed kind of playful at points. Like what I witnessed, in that encounter, like it went kind of oscillated between like controlling, scary, manic, and like, oh, well, give me a smile, show me what this would look like, put these on, try these on, and there was kind of almost lack, like, if you didn't know that something was off, you almost wouldn't think that there was something off, but everything else about the picture said bad business.
Right.
Yeah, and so I think just getting the vibe and not being afraid to
see something, call it say out. Something,
yeah.
Follow your intuition, and watch for cues,
yeah.
And listen to yourself. So just out there, you know, I'm going to go over when we finish here, kind of, I want to give people at least some different government websites and maybe Wish TV. We've covered this story. I'd like to get some sources together. And when we end this interview, I'll kind of drop it to the listeners. But yeah, just some basic stuff, basic tools. If you call the police, you know, the worst thing they can tell you is that you're wrong. And what are you losing by being wrong? Yeah. We can all be wrong sometimes when stuff like this is going
on.
Yeah,
your ego's not that important. You know, like I would have happily, and that's where I landed. You know, I told you I had that moment of like conflict of like, what if I'm wrong, right?
Right.
And then my ego, I'm like, you know what? My ego's not so big that I can't say I've made a mistake and apologize if I need to.
Yeah.
I'm like, I would much rather apologize for being wrong than to always wonder, like, what happened to her if I didn't do something.
And people aren't ever remembered by not doing anything. You're remembered by taking action on all things in your life.
Yeah.
Right, Lisa?
Absolutely.
Like, unplugging, getting divorced, moving out. Like,
yeah. You know, all that stuff. Yeah.
You're remembered. We're very happy for you. We're so happy we're friends with you.
Yes.
You're an amazing person, and we think you're...
I have cool friends. It works out well.
And you're just very driven and successful. And where can people find you?
People can find me, on Indie Style. I'm on every third Tuesday on Channel 8 here in Indianapolis at Wish 10 TV. O'clock. Right? Wish TV. What up? And then also at powerbodylanguage.com is my website, so they can find out more programs. And then I have the Lisa Mitchell Show podcast, where I do body language and decoding for all sorts of different contexts, not just for this. But I think everybody can really be heroes and be crime fighters and just... Open their eyes, take action, and know what to look for.
Yeah, I think this was an amazing podcast, and we really appreciate your time.
Thank you so much, Lisa.
Thanks for having
me. It's good to see you.
It's good to see you guys.
And at the end of every episode, I like to say, stay safe. I'd like you to say it this time. So in 3, 2.
Stay safe.
All right.
Bye, guys.
All right, now it's time for you all to become superheroes. I did a little bit of research, and I want to bring you some facts from different websites and articles that I found online. It's going to be really quick, but it'll be important for you to hear this stuff. So the first article I'm going to read is from August 7th, 2019, from WIBC. It's a radio station here in Indianapolis, but they also do news. This is the headline. Indy's Mobile News says, human trafficking is a multi-billion-dollar global industry, according to the American Hotel and Lodging Association. So Indiana hotels, because of what we talked about with Lisa, they're joining a national effort to put an end to human trafficking. The president of the American Hotel and Lodging Association is Chip Rogers. Now, he says the staff is increasing awareness to spot the signs of trouble, which is exactly what we wanted to hear, especially from what Lisa's perspective is. You know, we train up those people who are at the front of the line, then maybe things might change a little bit different. But this is what Chip Rogers had to say, according to WIBC. Our ultimate goal is that trafficking be eradicated from the U.S. hotel industry. Rogers said the best way to do that is to make sure everyone on staff in the hotels is trained up. Rogers then laid out some of the signs that human trafficking or traffickers could be in the hotel or staying where you're at. So when you see people together of dramatically different ages that are not related to each other, whether you have an excessive number of guests coming in and out of one hotel room, and when you have guests checking in with little to no luggage, those are three basic signs that you can be paying attention to. Think about it this way. If you're at a hotel and it's all hours of the night and people are coming in and out. I mean, obviously that's annoying and you should be reporting them, but it also could mean something bigger. So reporting them might be the best thing for that person if there could be an alleged victim inside. So the National Human Trafficking Hotline, again, this is WIBC's article still, says that the Indiana last year, there were over 140 cases of human trafficking reported and nearly 50 calls from victims and survivors. Also, the AHLA, again, which is the American Hotel and Lodging Association, launched the No Room for Trafficking campaign to help hospitality workers across America better identify traffickers and potential victims in hotels. Ultimately, that guy, Chip Rogers, says human trafficking is a $150 billion a year industry affecting about 40 million victims. I mean, how can we just ignore this stuff? And finally, if you believe someone is being trafficked because they're showing signs like what Lisa was talking about, they're fearful of authority, they're fearful of the person they're with, like their trafficker. It could be even family members if they escape. They show signs of physical or psychological trauma, or they have untreated conditions. Maybe they're just bruised or have open wounds, like stuff like that. Also, fearful of telling others about their situation, And also, sometimes, like Lisa said, they're unaware that they're even being trafficked. They just assume that they did something wrong and they're being punished for it. So the big thing is dramatic age differences between the victim and the trafficker themselves. So just be aware when you're walking around. You never know. It's all you just heard it. 40 million Americans, or I should say, excuse me, 40 million victims, not globally, are sex trafficked. If you really need to get in touch with somebody, if there's something going on, the National Human Trafficking Hotline is 1-888-373-7888. Again, 888-373-7888. So there you go. You can also text HELP or INFO to 233-733. All day, 24 hours, 7 days a week, 365 days a year. If you believe you have information about a trafficking situation, you can call the National Human Trafficking Hotline, 888-373-7888. It advocates for, you know, saving these people. And one little thing, and like Lisa said, and I'll leave you with this, you can be a superhero. You can be the ones that make a difference. Just make the decision to not stand by idly and watch someone that you know in your heart that you can feel there's something wrong here. But, you know, the worst thing that can happen is they tell you, hey, man, you were wrong there. You know, you shouldn't have called us. But, you know, they're probably going to say we appreciate, you know, the effort. Because if you see something, you need to say something. It's all of our duty as a community. It's everybody's priority at this point to save as many children and people who are being trafficked as possible. There are predators out there. You need to be aware. I'm not trying to scare you. It's just the truth. Thanks again so much for joining me this week. Stay tuned for next week's episode. It's coming out 2 weeks from today. And with all the love in my heart, thank you so much for listening. And with that, stay safe.